So I'll read the word, word for word. Etat this matam, the conclusion, samatishta, remain fixed, paramena, by the Supreme, samadhina, concentration of the mind, bhavan, yourself, kalpa, intermediate devastation, vikalpishu, in the final devastation, na muhiti, will never bewilder, karhichit, anything like complacence. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O Brahma, just follow this conclusion by fixed concentration of mind, and no pride will disturb you, neither in the partial nor the final devastation.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada. As in the Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter, the personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, has summarized the whole text in four verses, namely, Aham Sarvasya Prabhava, etc. So the complete Srimad Bhagavatam has also been summarized in four verses as Aham Ivasam Evagre, etc. Thus the secret purpose of the most important Bhagavatite conclusion has been explained by the original speaker of the Srimad Bhagavatam, who is also the original speaker of the Bhagavad Gita, the personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna. There are many grammarians and non-devotee material wranglers who have tried to present false interpretations of these four texts of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But the Lord himself advised Brahmaji not to be deviated from the fixed conclusion the Lord had taught him. The Lord was a teacher of the nucleus of Srimad Bhagavatam in four verses, and Brahma was the receiver of the knowledge. Misinterpretation of the word aham by the word jugglery of the impersonalist should not disturb the mind of the strict followers of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is the text of the personality of Godhead and his unalloyed devotees, who are also known as the Bhagavatas, and any outsider should have no access to this confidential literature of devotional service. But unfortunately, the impersonalist, who has no relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, sometimes tries to interpret Srimad Bhagavatam by his poor fund of knowledge in grammar and dry speculation. Therefore, the Lord warns Brahma, and through Brahma, all future devotees of the Lord in the disciplic succession of Brahma, that one should never be misled by the conclusion of the so-called grammarians or by other men with a poor fund of knowledge, but must always fix the mind properly via the parampara system. No one should try to give a new interpretation by dint of mundane knowledge. And the first step, therefore, in pursuance of the system of knowledge received by Brahma, is to approach a bona fide guru who is the representative of the Lord following the parampara system. No one should try to squeeze out his own meaning by imperfect mundane knowledge. The guru, or the bona fide spiritual master, is competent to teach the disciple in the right path with reference to the context of all authentic Vedic literature. He does not attempt to juggle words to bewilder the student. The bona fide spiritual master, by his personal activities, teaches the disciple the principles of devotional service. Without devotional service, one would go on speculating like the impersonalists and dry speculators life after life and would be unable to reach the final conclusion. By following the instructions of the bona fide spiritual master, in conjunction with the principles of revealed scriptures, the student will rise to the plane of complete knowledge, which will be exhibited by development of detachment from the world of sense gratification. The mundane wranglers are surprised that one can detach himself from the world of sense gratification, and thus any attempt to be fixed in God realization appears to them to be mysticism. This detachment from the sensory world is called the Brahma-Bhuta stage of realization, the preliminary stage of transcendental devotional life, Parabhakti. The Brahma-Bhuta stage of life is also known as the Atmarama stage, in which one is fully self-satisfied and does not hanker for the world of sense enjoyment. This stage of full satisfaction is the proper situation for understanding the transcendental knowledge of the personality of Godhead. The Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.20 affirms this. Evang prasanna manaso bhagavad bhakti yogataha bhagavat tattva vijnanam mukta sangasya jayate. Thus, in the completely satisfied stage of life, exhibited by full detachment from the world of sense enjoyment as a result of performing devotional service, one can understand the science of God in the liberated stage. In this stage of full satisfaction and detachment from the sensory world, one can know the mystery of the science of God with all its confidential intricacies, and not by grammar or academic speculation. Because Brahma qualified himself for such reception, the Lord was pleased to disclose the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam. This direct instruction by the Lord to any devotee who is detached from the world of sense gratification is possible, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 10.10. Te shang satata yuktanang bhajatang priti purvakam dadi bhumi buddhi yogang tang yena mam upayanti te. Unto the devotees who are constantly engaged in the Lord's transcendental loving service, priti purvakam, the Lord, out of his causeless mercy upon the devotee, gives direct instructions so that the devotee may make accurate progress on the path returning home, back to Godhead. One should not, therefore, try to understand these four verses of Srimad Bhagavatam by mental speculation. Rather, by direct perception of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is able to know all about his abode, Vaikuntha, as was seen and experienced by Brahmaji. Such Vaikuntha realization is possible by any devotee of the Lord situated in the transcendental position as a result of devotional service. In the Gopala Tapani Upanishad, Shruti, it is said, Gopa Vesho Me Purushak Purustad Avir Bhabhuva. The Lord appeared before Brahma as a cowboy, that is, as the original personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna Govinda, who is later described by Brahmaji in his Brahma Samhita. Chintamani prakara sadmasu kalpaviksha lakshavriteshu sudabhir abhipalyantam lakshmi sahasra satasam brahma sevyamanam govindam adi purusham tamahang bhajami. Brahmaji desires to worship the original personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, who resides in the topmost Vaikuntha planet known as Goloka Vrindavan, where he is in the habit of keeping Surabhi cows as a cowboy, and where he is served by hundreds and thousands of goddesses of fortune, the gopis, with love and respect. Therefore, Lord Sri Krishna is the original form of the Supreme Lord, Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. This is also clear from this instruction. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is Lord Krishna, and not directly Narayan or the Purusha avatars, which are subsequent manifestations. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam means consciousness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, and Srimad Bhagavatam is the sound representation of the Lord as much as the Bhagavad Gita is. Thus, the conclusion is that Srimad Bhagavatam is the science of the Lord, in which the Lord and his abode are perfectly realized.
Thank you, Prabhu. Om Ganati Mirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshur Unminitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukham Karoti Vachanam Pangung Langayate Garim Yakripa Tamaham Bande Shri Gurun Dinataranam Vanchakalpa Tarubhyas Tirakripa Sinyuvi Evacha Patitanang Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. The translation again, O Brahma, just follow this conclusion by fixed concentration of mind, and no pride will disturb you, either in the partial nor in the final devastation. In the last four verses, we just now concluded the Chatur Shloks, and Krishna has spoken to Lord Brahma, the first created being. Actually, the entire Srimad Bhagavatam compacted into four verses, four we just read. And these four verses were later expanded into 18,000 verses, which is the Srimad Bhagavatam, which we have. And my understanding is that it's expanded even further on other planets, other higher planets, other places in the universe, and perhaps in even more so in other larger, more complex universes where we have a greater capacity to understand this infinite knowledge. And even though it is expanding, it's not like something material. That all material things that expand, they actually become a little diluted as they expand, or certainly in most cases, just like a cloud of smoke. As that smoke dissipates, it expands out further, it becomes weaker and weaker. Or light, if you shine light in a certain direction, as that light travels, it's going to get weaker and weaker. And sound as well. The farther it goes, the fainter it is. But actually the exact opposite, when we're talking about Krishna's energy, expanding these verses of the Bhagavatam, they begin infinite, with infinite meaning and infinite sweetness. And as these are expanded by the great Vaishnavas, not only do they not lose potency or sweetness, but actually they increase and become even sweeter. 18,000 verses. But Srila Prabhupada has taken and expanded that sweetness without any loss, the opposite, an increase in potency by his Bhaktivedanta purports. And factually, as we speak, all of us, if we remain faithful to the Guru Parampara, we also expand the knowledge by revealing it through our own realizations. So anyway, having spoken these four verses, Brahma, now in today's verse, is advising Lord Brahma, Krishna is advising Lord Brahma, that if he follows the conclusion of this very confidential and transcendental knowledge by fixed concentration of mind, then no pride will disturb him under any circumstances. So today I thought I would speak a little about pride, the evils of pride, the tenacious quality of pride. And ultimately the conclusion is going to be, which the thread of the Prabhupada's purport is, by detachment from the desire for sense gratification. Let's back up a little bit and remember specifically why Krishna is mentioning the word pride, or speaking about pride in today's verse. So just sort of as a summary, a little capsule summary, we know that Lord Brahma was born from the lotus navel of Karnadakshai Vishnu, and on the lotus, and he, out of his natural inquisitiveness to understand the source of his existence, he climbed down but found only darkness. Ending it to perform austerities, so he climbed back up, went into deep meditation, and very perfectly as he meditated, Krishna was pleased. And as Krishna was pleased, the result came that Krishna revealed himself to Lord Brahma. And then he told Lord Brahma that he would be given the service of creating variegatedness within this material world, and in particular various bodies of the living entities, and later to disseminate spiritual knowledge. Now, as we sort of fast forward, Brahma had understood that he would accomplish this insurmountable task of creating the variegatedness, the bodies of the living entities, and disseminating spiritual knowledge. But Brahma knew that he would do this as an instrument. At the same time, he knew very well the dangers and the power of pride and false ego that may enter in by creating delusions and madness in his own mind and heart. And therefore, he prayed. Now, if we go back to text 29, not very far back, this is all just preceding these Chatur Shlokas, Brahma asked Krishna how I can act instrumentally to generate living entities without being conditioned by such activities. And in text 30, Lord Brahma prays, "O my Lord, the unborn, you have shaken hands with me, just as a friend does with a friend, as if in equal position. I shall be engaged in the creation of different types of living entities, and I shall be occupied in your service. I shall have no perturbation." That means like unsteadiness or flustering. "But I pray," listen carefully, "but I pray that all this may not give rise to pride, as if I were the Supreme." Sort of in a very similar way in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna told Arjuna, "Nimitta matra bhava sabhi sachin," simply become my instrument, or "ma karma palahetur bor." He told Arjuna that we should never ever think ourselves as the doer, the cause of what has actually happened. And as soon as one's thinking falls into the mode of thinking that I am in fact the doer, then, as Krishna says in the Gita, "Ahankara vimutatma kartaham iti manyate," that ahankara, by the influence, one becomes bewildered, vimutatma, bewildered, ahankara, by this false ego, and kartaham iti manyate, he's thinking that he is a doer. So this is Brahma's focus. He does not want to fall into the trap of the illusion that he is in fact the doer. Now, it's interesting to see how this word pride is used both just before and in today's verse, where Brahma's asking to not become subjected and contaminated by pride. But it's interesting that in text 30, Name Samudat Madho Jamanina, that where he's saying, "I pray that all this may not give rise to pride," Samudata Madha. Samudha means resulting or arising from, and Madha means madness. So Prabhupada is translating Madha as madness, but yet in the purport he refers to it as pride. In other words, pride, madness, false ego are all really synonymous. Or we could certainly say that madness or pride is the immediate symptom of the false ego. And in today's verse, again, the last line of the verse, "na vimuhyati karhichit." Again, we have the word vimuhyati, and "Navi Mukhyati Karhichit," which Prabhupada, and we know Mukhyati means to be never be bewildered, and Prabhupada defines it exactly that way in the word for word, "Navi Mukhyati," never be bewildered. But yet, again, in his translation, he says, "Let pride not disturb you." So it's important we see this connection between pride, false ego, and illusion or bewilderment. Now, why was Brahma so concerned about pride? And the answer is that every living entity within this material world who is in any way conditioned is full of pride. In fact, if we think about the creation of this material cosmic manifestation, when this world was created, the first thing manifests as the Mahatattva. And that Mahatattva is like a big cloud which blocks the conditioned soul's ability to see Krishna, the spiritual world. But the very first thing that comes from the Mahatattva is the false ego. So in other words, the false ego is the first thing to come. It's the most subtle covering. It's the first to come. And, as we're going to learn today, it's the last thing to go. It's pride and egoism. It's the last snare, if you will. And we see that every living entity and we have examples all the way from Indra to the most insignificant little ant. They're all conditioned. But interestingly, that within the heart of every living being, love of Krishna lies in a covered or dormant stage. And as Mahaprabhu spoke the very famous verse to Sanatana Goswami, Anicca Siddha Krishna Prem Shudya Kabo Noi Shavanada Shitti Chitti Kuriyeru Doi, that in every living being's heart, albeit covered by the false ego, lies dormant love of God. Even a worm in stool has an eternal rasa with Krishna. That worm in his heart knows the essence of all the Vedas. But due to the cloud of false ego and pride, that pure, eternal servant of Krishna, in that most abominable form, he is thinking, I am the king of this stool. I am the enjoyer of the stool. I am very perfectly crawling very deftly through the stool. And by the way, you see this beautiful little female worm next to me? She's my consort. And I'll be very happy living here in this stool. It's kind of like Indra. We know the story when Indra was cursed by Brihaspati to take the body of a pig. He was thinking that he was the enjoyer of his female pig and his little piglets and so on. And this should all sound very familiar. As Krishna says in the Gita, Ishvaroham Mahambhogi Siddhoham Balavansaki. This is everyone is thinking, Ishvaroham, that I am controlling. Ahambhogi, I am the enjoyer. Siddhoham, that I am perfect. Balavan, very powerful. And Sukhi, that this is all for my enjoyment. And every conditioned soul, either subtly or grossly, is thinking in this way as false pride and identification with the material body contaminates him, and which is actually the source of all suffering within this world. It is that attachment to the false pride, this thinking that I am the doer, that I am anything other than the servant of Krishna. That is why we suffer within this world. And to whatever degree we are able to rid ourselves of this very grotesque false pride, to that degree our service becomes very very pleasing to Krishna and all the devotees. I mean, pride is so totally distasteful to those who are on the spiritual path. And if any one of us wants to completely diminish our reputation among the Vaishnavas, here's a pretty good technique to do it. Simply start extolling your glories and your accomplishments, and everyone will think you're fool number one. I am an expert preacher. I'm the best cook. I do nirjal every Ekadasi. I have many followers. I am a very advanced devotee. I'm the best pujari. So many examples. The more we speak in this way, the more we expose the ghastly and repugnant pride and lack of Krishna consciousness within our hearts. And when devotees hear us speaking our own glories, extolling our greatness, devotees will avoid us just like the plague. Or, and I'll make that more up to date, just like we have Ebola virus. So similarly, it's kind of interesting that even if among gross materialists we sort of adulate or sing our own glories, that listing our accomplishments and qualification, the materialists will simply become envious of us. And if they are in fact somehow impressed, that will always be mixed with envy. So in other words, this extolling our own greatness and pride, no one likes it, neither the materialist nor the devotees. And this is why Mahaprabhu so strongly stresses Trinata Pisa Nichena, Torora Pisa Hishnuna, Amanina Manidina Kirtaniya Sadhari, and that we must feel ourselves Trinata Pisa Nichena, more downtrodden or lower than the blade of grass, and Torora Pisa Hishnuna, more tolerant than a tree you can take its fruit. You can, it will give you shelter, but you chop at the tree and cut it down, it doesn't object. And Amanina and Amanadena, the ready offering all respects to others, Kirtaniya Sadhari, then one is able to chant the holy name of the Lord very perfectly. In fact, we're advised to string this verse around our neck, never forgetting our position as simply a humble servant of the Lord, and unable to accomplish or do anything without the empowerment of the Vaishnavas, our guru, and ultimately, of course, Krishna. Now, regarding pride, I guess we should mention it, that there is a sort of a flip side or a positive side of pride, spiritual pride, which is in fact a good thing. I mean, spiritual pride means being proud of others, not our own self. For example, we're very proud of the wonderful things that Krishna does. I mean, the loving exchange with his devotees, how Krishna fulfills his promise to come to the material world and annihilate demons and restore the religious principles. And boy, are we ever proud of Srila Prabhupada for his litany of inconceivable and unimaginable accomplishments. We're very proud to see the service done by our godbrothers and godsisters and nephews and our aunts and our uncles in our spiritual association. When we hear about great personalities like Raghunath Das, Madhavendra Puri, we naturally become very, very proud. And we should be proud to be a soldier in Lord Chaitanya and Srila Prabhupada's army, delivering this love of God indiscriminately to anyone who will take it. But we must constantly remember that we are simply instruments, so that our real spiritual pride does not degrade into false pride. Now, we're describing the false ego and pride as being like a cloud. And certainly clouds take different forms, just like, for example, in the rainy season, the clouds are very dark, and in the summer season they're much more tenuous. But in either case, whether it is a thin or tenuous cloud or very dark cloud, they're still blocking the sun. And how this is tying in, dark clouds would be demoniac people like Ravana, Kamsa, Haranyakashipu, and the list goes on. But there's also examples of great devotees that also are covered by a more tenuous cloud. And in appearing in a much more subtle form. And a good example was the great king Bharat Maharaj, who ruled this world so expertly for 10 million years. How am I doing for time? Okay, so if time allows, I'm going to try to narrate a little bit of the story of King Bharat, so we can see how all of this this tenacious and very hidden form of pride can lurk so deeply in our hearts, and often not recognizable to our intelligence. So as we know, Maharaj Bharat was very famous as a great king for performing so many sacrifices, Agnihotras, horse sacrifice, many, Pashu Jagya, which is, you know, we often talk about meat eating, that originally old animals were put into a fire, and by the very expert chanting of mantras, completely unharmed, the animal would come trotting out with a very young body. And this is Pashu Jagya, and Maharaj Bharat performed so many of such sacrifices. And in fact, he was such a great king that our planet was actually named after him, isn't it? Bharat Varsa. The original name was Ajanaba, and Ajanaba was named after King Nabi. But somehow, I guess the accomplishments of Mahabharat, for some reason, they superseded or they changed the name of our planet to Bharat Varsa. So after ruling his kingdom for many, many years, 10 million to be exact, and after completing all of his kingly duties, he divided his kingdom among his five sons. And we should understand that now the king is getting ready to depart his kingdom. But there was absolutely nothing in this world that King Bharat couldn't have. I mean, think, he was the king of the entire world and was absolutely the beloved of everyone. But still, due to his great attachment to Krishna in his heart, and understanding the purpose of life was not to simply remain in this role of a king, but was to now go and perfect his life by totally giving up all attachments and fully surrendering his heart to Krishna. He left everything. There's that nice verse, Yudhishthira Darasutan Suhrid Rajan Hridi Sprishaha. Jahau Yuvaiva Malavat Uttama Shloka Lalasa. So Jahau Yuvaiva Malavat. Malavat means like stool. Jahal, which means he gave up. Yuvaiva, in his youth, he was still a young, beautiful man. Jahal Yuvaiva Malavat Uttama Shloka Lalasa. He gave it up because of the great attachment he was feeling to the Lord and wanting to continue on in the path of perfection. So the king departed, and he went to Puloha Ashram, which was in Hardwar. And he at the Gandaki River. Now this area, also called, what's the other name of it? Shalagram something. I don't remember the exact name, but it was very famous for having many, many shalagrams there. I mean, the river, the Gandaki River, so many stones were shalagrams, and therefore saintly persons would often go there. And this is where the king departed for, and the Pula Ashram. And so he was performing his devotional practices, and within his heart he was worshiping Lord Narayan. And his execution of his devotional practices was so successful that he was beginning to manifest in his body the ashtasattvaka transformations. That's where the bodily symptoms of ecstasy, such as crying and trembling of the body and the hair standing on end, these things were beginning to appear. And his bhava was so mature that he had practically come to the level of pure love of God, and he had given up virtually everything, subtle and gross. And Sukadeva Goswami explains that King Bharat was freed from practically all material contamination. He describes that he gave up attachment, lust, greed, but as we're going to see a little further, didn't quite let go of the false pride. So one day, King Bharat, after bathing in the Gandaki River and chanting various mantras, he was sitting and he noticed that there was a doe, a female deer, that was taking drink from the Gandaki River. But then all of a sudden he heard the most tumultuous roar of a lion, which mortified the doe, and in great panic and trepidation, the doe jumped into the river and in great haste was swimming across, but because of the great disturbance of mind and fear raging in her heart, she miscarried. And by the time she got to the other side of the river, she was so exhausted that she walked a short way and she found a little cave, and she went into that cave and she left her body. Now, here's where the pride begins. So seeing that this little baby deer was now washing down the river, King Bharat thought, I will save this deer. And he jumps into the river and he grabs a poor helpless little deer and he brings him and he sets him to rest on the bank. And he's thinking, you know, I did it. I just saved this deer. And I henceforward will protect this young deer from the lions and the tigers. Now, if we think for a minute, from a materialistic standpoint, this act of compassion for the young deer may be very laudable and benevolent and certainly in the mode of goodness. But from the spiritual point of view, the king was actually falling from his exalted position by neglecting his spiritual practices and unnecessarily becoming attached to this animal and thereby degrading himself. He was deviating from the instructions of his spiritual master. So this false pride now that was beginning to awaken was fueling these bonds of affection for the deer. And it's described when he, little fawn felt a little itch that King Bharat was petting and scratching, and often was kissing the little deer, and he would walk with the deer and eat with the little deer and bathe with the deer. And when he slept, often the little deer was on his chest. And in fact, when Mahabharata was in meditation, it's described that he would close his eyes as if in deep meditation and feign meditation when he even admits that he was simply thinking of the deer. And then after a short period of time, really only a number of days, he completely forgot everything about his spiritual practices. Now, one day the deer disappears, and in great anxiety, King Bharat goes looking, and he's thinking, I must find the deer. He's put his faith in me. And King Bharat is thinking that this little deer, he doesn't know anyone but me. He's thinking, I am his father. He's thinking, I am his mother. I am his brother. I am the sum total of all of his relatives. The deer has faith in me. He's taken shelter of me. I must protect him. Then, thinking in this way, the king, I mean, he started going, you know, totally out of his mind. And he started to proclaim like a total madman. He was describing that the due to the earth's severe penances, the footsteps of this deer, which are very small and beautiful and auspicious and soft, that they are imprinting the surface of this fortunate planet. And by the presence, he says, of these footprints, the earth has now become a proper place for brahmanas who desire passage into the heavenly planets, or those who even want liberation. The king even looked up at the moon, and as he saw the dark spots in the moon, He saw them as the deer. And he started proclaiming that perhaps the moon has given shelter to his little deer to protect him from the fearful lions. And he goes on describing how his heart is burning from the loss of his son, just like a land lily in a great forest fire. But the moon, like a good friend, he described, was splashing him with its cooling rays. So anyway, in the course of searching after this deer in total madness and in great lamentation, the king finally fell down and he left his body. But at the moment he was leaving his body, the king looked and he saw the deer sitting right next to him. And the deer was lamenting, just like a son was lamenting the death of his beloved father. And now with his mind totally absorbed in thoughts of this little fawn, he transferred to the womb of a doe. So we all know the famous verse in Gita where Krishna says, Yang yang vapi smaram bhavan chajichante kalevaram tantang evaiti kuntiya siddhanta bhava bhavita, which is describing that whatever one is thinking, whatever state of mind one has at the time of death when he's giving up his body, Krishna says, that state he will attain without fail. But as Krishna promises in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, kuntiya pratijanihi name bhakta panashriti, that Krishna tells Arjuna, and it's interesting, by the way, Krishna doesn't proclaim name bhakta pratijanihi, he doesn't declaim it himself that I will always protect my devotee. He asked Arjuna to do it. Kuntiya pratijanihi, pratijanihi means to proclaim. Kuntiya pratijanihi, Arjuna, you say it, because, you know, Krishna's had a little reputation for sometimes not being true to his word. But Arjuna was, in that sense, a very noble. So, anyway, keeping this promise of always protecting his devotee, when the king was now taking the body of a deer, he did not forget his previous life. And as we mentioned yesterday in our short discussion after Maharaj read the purport, that when we were talking about animals becoming perfected, and we mentioned that that when Maharaj Bharat entered into that body of a deer, that he was actually more desirous than ever to attain perfection and completely purify himself. I mean, sometimes if the devotee falls down, that fall down can actually be a blessing in disguise if we use it in that way. Prabhupada one time said, let your failures be your pillar of success, and that is first class. So anyway, the king was very aware of the weed of pride that he had not fully uprooted. So he was taking every precaution, and therefore he... he was born in Kanjura Mountain, Kalanjura Mountain. But he very quickly, as a young deer, departed right back to the ashram where he had originally been performing his devotional practices back at the Gandaki River at the holy Pulaha Ashram in the forest of the Shalagrams. And there he had, you know, there's a nice association of devotees. He was always hearing spiritual sound. But actually, he was just awaiting his death. And then when the time finally came, as Krishna says in Gita, Shuchinam Srimatangehe Yoga Brasabhajayate, he took his birth in the family of great Brahmanas. But he did not want to make the same mistake he made before. So he acted so that no one would offer him any respect at all, and so that he wouldn't even feel any respect for himself with his own heart. He acted like a very dull, sort of idiotic, deaf and dumb person. And his father, who was a great Brahmana, loved his son very much, in spite of his apparent lack of qualifications. And he tried to give him the thread, the sacred thread. He tried to train him in so many ways, but he was, you know, untrainable. I mean, his father would teach him to pass stool and then you bathe. But Jeta Bharat would pass stool. No, he would, my dyslexia here, he would bathe and then pass stool. I'm sorry, I'm dyslexic. And so anyway, actually, I mean, everyone was seeing this, that Jeta Bharat was you know, useless. He was idiotic, like a lunatic. And actually, Jeta Bharat loved it because he felt very insulated from the dangers of pride. Now, after his father left this world, his stepmother and siblings, they began to treat Jeta Bharat very, very poorly. And they were feeding him the most condemned types of foodstuffs. But Jeta Bharat, he never complained, because within his heart, he was constantly worshiping and chanting the glories of Lord Narayan. And he was very careful to never associate or be anywhere near the non-devotees, a satsang chag, a Vaishnava char. And now, the story starts to get really interesting. Not that it wasn't interesting in the beginning. But so one day, we're running short of time, so I'm really going to summarize. One day, while the king, Rahugana, was passing through being parried on a palanquin, they needed a third person to carry that palanquin. And Jeta Bharat was there, and they saw, wow, he's big, he looks strong, and he seems like a likely person to do the work. So they ordered Jeta Bharat to carry the palanquin. And of course, very humbly, he didn't object. So, but when he was carrying the palanquin, he was, you know, being so advanced in spiritual life, he didn't want to step on any ants. So he was, you know, avoiding walking this way and that way and keeping a very irregular pace. And it was sort of messing up the whole ride that the king was enjoying. So the king began to speak with very, very foul language, chastising Jeta Bharat, who, you know, he was unfazed. So, because Jeta Bharat was unfazed, the king then threatened him with punishment. And at this point, Jeta Bharat began to speak. And the words that emanated from the mouth of Jeta Bharat were so pure, so potent, and so cutting, that they immediately awakened within the heart of the king a very intense desire to understand the absolute truth. And realizing, you know, the king, that he had made a great offense by offending this great devotee, he fell down and begged that Jeta Bharat forgive him. Now, we don't have time to go into the incredible dialogue, but suffice to say that Jeta Bharat completely enlightened the king. And in fact, in the course of the discussion, after Jeta Bharat finished speaking to the king was so taken by that he asked him to repeat it so that he wouldn't miss, make sure he absolutely understood everything. Now, in my opinion, perhaps the most amazing and instructive lesson that Jeta Bharat taught us, Jeta Bharat, King Bharat, the same personality in all these three lifetimes, perhaps the most instructive happened after Jeta Bharat had enlightened the king. And what is that? He simply slipped away and very inconspicuously slipped away from the crowd and entered back into the forest and began once again taking up the role of a total madman so that he would never be contaminated by pride. I mean, he could have enjoyed the prestige of being one of the most celebrated preachers of all time, you know, lived a very comfortable life in the palace of the king. But on the contrary, he didn't want any recognition at all, knowing the dangers of it. And Judd Barat, he realized that he really didn't do anything. He didn't speak. Who spoke? He was thinking in his mind, Krishna has spoken. The parampara has spoken through me. I've done nothing. I am simply an instrument. And, therefore, he departed off to the forest. And you know, of course, we cannot imitate Judd Barat, but at least we can understand how important it is to avoid this false pride and prestige in our lives. Okay, so before I end, before I conclude, I want to let us all hear what Raghunath Das Goswami and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur have to say about the evils of false pride and honor. Because if what we have spoken so far with my very limited potency in speaking hasn't done it, I want to sort of drive the final nail in the coffin, or the coup d'etat. So I want to read, this is very short, but I want to read from the Manakshiksha. In fact, Dhruva Maharaj, my dear friend who's staying with us, I was told him that today I'd be speaking about pride, and he suggested this, that I read this section from the Manakshiksha. So this is verse number 7. I'll read the translation. This is Raghunath Das. He says, "My dear brother mind, the despicable desire for material honor and distinction is compared to a shameless and low-born prostitute who eats dog meat. Yet, she is flagrantly dancing in my heart. How then can the pristine love of pure devotion to Krishna ever find a place in my heart? You will simply have to serve the unalloyed devotees of the Lord, who are the intimate associates and stalwart supporters. They alone can drive out this prostitute and enthrone pure love of God in your heart." Bhaktivinoda commenting. This verse indicates how one can extinguish any remaining doubt he may have if his repeated and exhaustive attempts to weed out deceit from his heart have failed. Hankering for honor is in fact a shameless prostitute who yearns to be worshipped. All other unwanted desires may be eradicated, but the hankering for honor and distinction is extremely difficult to uproot. It is like a seed which sprouts only later into a deceitful plant, a matrix from which all other anarthas stem. This is called shameless, for it conveniently overlooks its own evil influence. Shame is like a dog, and one who runs after it is factually eating the flesh of a dog. Thus, the desire for material honor and distinction is compared to a low-class prostitute who consumes dog meat. Jai. So we're right at the bewitching hour here. Let me just read the translation again, and we're going to turn it back over to Ramananda. O Brahma, just follow the conclusion. Just follow this conclusion of fixed concentration of mind, and no pride will disturb you, neither in the partial nor in the final devastation. Jai, so thank you all very much for your kind attention. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Ramananda-ji, let's see if anyone has a comment or correction or what have you.
I've unmuted everyone.
I found one word that would be interesting to note is the word for pride in Sanskrit a lot of times is darpa or darpanam. And it's quite similar. In fact, there's only like one dot different between darpanam and darpanam, which means mirror. So I was wondering if there's a connection between pride and mirror, that we're cleansing the dust from the mirror of our heart, cheto darpanam marginam.
Well, whether there's, you know, direct literary connection, I don't know. We're talking about cleansing the mirror of the mind, so all I can say, Madan, I don't have a lot to say on that other than we're trying to clean. We read, you know, when you clean a mirror, I know, for example, when I'm cleaning my computer screen, I have this nice special spray to clean the screen and a special non-static cloth that I use. But before I do it, I just take a paper towel and some water and wash it first, because there's all this gross dust and big pieces on the screen. And then once that's done, then I can go for the really, really fine stuff, just like the cleansing of the Gunjita temple, that after they swept so much water was used. So cleansing that heart, cleansing our heart, the dharpanam, cleansing that all those anartas in our heart, the finest of the fine, the last of the tiny particles, is like pride. Look how advanced King Bharat was in his meditation. It's described he had almost reached pure love of God. His bhava was so mature, it was like the high end of bhava. But still, the pride was still there. Thank you. Anyone else?
Well, the only connection I once saw was a mirror that's on top of a bureau that the women put their makeup on. It's called a vanity.
Mm.
So I just thought that was kind of like how these things sneak into our, so we can see the connection, you know, the mirrors and vanities and pride.
I always thought that, and I think we could look at all this differently, that the mirror is, you know, cleansing the mirror of the mind. The mirror, you know, you just can't see through a mirror. You can't see clearly, like a window. You know, you can't see through a window until it's clean, and just you can't see clearly what's being reflected, the pure, you know, everything is so perverted that we see in this world. But when we really clean and clean and clean and clean that mirror, we'll see Krishna reflected everywhere.
Madan Mohan Prabhu, that's so perceptive of you. There, Bhakti Vigyan Swami speaks extensively about that, yeah, dharpana is the word for a mirror, and that's what it means. The mirror of proud, because the mind is always telling us how wonderful we are.
Nice.
So it's just like a mirror. And interesting, he was also saying, it's really great that... you know, in the Mana Shiksha, how it describes that pride is such an insidious thing that we have to overcome. Even if we don't have it now, it will come. You know, like if there's not much for us to be proud of, then it's kind of easy to be humble. But, you know, once you start getting empowered in different ways, even if you didn't have it before, it'll come.
Right.
So it's something that we have to really purify ourselves from.
That's why it says here, why Bhaktivinoda in its purport says, it is like a seed which sprouts only later into a deceitful plant, a matrix from which all other anartas stem. That was a nice point, Madan. Thank you.
Well, it's also seen as a weed that, in other words, when you do things in Krishna's service, people start to say things. And if using an old term, either claim jumper or an embezzler, they're actually praising Krishna that's speaking through you. So here's Krishna directly speaking through you. Instead, you say, well, no, that's actually me.
Definitely.
I guess humility would be the antithesis. So you would say you're actually seeing that this is Krishna doing it. But if you have still that tendency, then it manifests. I guess so. It's a combination, with chemistry. Add a little envy, and then you can turn, when someone says something nice about Krishna, you just kind of like embezzle it, and it turns into pride for yourself.
Actually, Ravnanda, I want to disagree with you a little bit, because you said that when we don't have anything, it's easy to be humble. Well, originally Krishna gave us this mirror that from the beginning we are actually proud. People proud when they are rascals or they don't have even anything, they still gonna find something to be proud about. So it's
That's a
always
great point.
There.
That's a great point. I see, I was down at a homeless camp and at sort of the park, not very far from where we live, and I was seeing how how proud the homeless people are of their little area and their little spot, and this is mine and that's not yours, and demanding respect from other people in a little homeless park. I mean, it's true. Even that worm in stool is also very proud.
Prabhupada would say a pauper is proud of his penny.
Nice. Tata.
So, I have something to add here. But Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, I heard, did not use mirrors, not even to put on tilak. Yeah, the mirror is very interesting. It's you don't want to look in a mirror too long. Anyway, in the mid 70s.
Excuse me, I kind of like looking in the mirror now because I'm getting older. See my jowl starting to come, and turkey neck is appearing, and my eyelids are drooping, and maybe when you're younger, when you're older, it can be helpful. I'm sorry, Prabhu, go ahead, please.
No problem. In the mid-70s, Srila Prabhupada sent Bhardwaj, who was arguably at the time his most talented artist, he sent him to West Bengal to learn how to make dioramas. So Srila Prabhupada's residence in Calcutta was close to a place called Kumartuli, where dioramas artists, they make these elaborate, beautiful, ornate images of Saraswati and Durga Devi for their annual pujas. And then on one of Srila Prabhupada's first world tours, the devotees took him to see Madame Tussaud's famous wax museum in London. So he actually wrote to Bhardwaj that if this diorama project is successful, it will mean his preaching will be successful in the West. He really encouraged this, and this is one reason I got involved in the project. But when Bhardwaj arrived in Mayapur and started going to the diorama artist community nearby in Krishnanagar to learn the art of dioramas, part of that training was to break the models he was sculpting. Now, this is a very talented artist. And the training was, you make them and you break them. So when I heard this from him, I understood that the system was designed to break his attachment to his early and perhaps unique creations, it was to humble the person that was training. So when I hear this verse where the Lord is responding to a few verses earlier, Brahma's expressed fear of becoming a victim of pride for, you know, generating the universal creation, I mean, that's a pretty big...
How do you not become proud?
That's a creation. The Lord's reminding Brahma here that there will be a partial and total devastation of his creation. In fact, Brahma himself will be swept away at the Mahapralaya with all the other living entities into the body of Mahavishnu. So, reminding him of this, he'll be saved of pride. So, you know, Brahma, he's been given, you know, not only he's coming from the navel of Vishnu, but he's unborn, but he's been given the basic ingredients and the power to create. But he won't be able to control the fate of his creation, which he will also see destroyed partially and totally. And so, although his life and the universe goes on for an extended period of time, he can remember that all this will end one day.
Wow. Excellent point. That's great. Thank you, Prabhu. That was brilliant.
What about the pride of an exalted birth? Oh, I was born in a Brahmin family. I was born in a Vaishnava family. I was born from the lotus flower springing from the navel of God. Talk about a high birth and the pride that could lead to.
Wow. A great point. Yeah, Queen Kunti, the famous verse, Janmaisvarya Shruti Shubir Edamana Kadakpaman, that the high birth, Janma, the first of the list, Jan Aishvarya Shruti Shubir, The first thing he lists on that of those four is being born in a high family. Great point, Prabhu. Thank you. It's the highest birth of all. Who else is born directly of Krishna like that? First created being. Great point.
There is a question in the chat from Damayanti.
I don't have.
Okay, I can read it. What are some ways to detect that we are still acting with a false pride?
Good question. I would say the safest is to have keeping good association with devotees and having very, very, very dear friends. Dear friends that are close enough to us that they will tell us, that they'll reveal to us when they detect pride. And one of the types of loving exchange is guyam akyati prishyati. That means speaking and revealing in confidence. And sometimes a spiritual master will detect that, or a senior devotee will detect it, or one of our peers will detect it. But we have to be humble enough to hear. I mean, I can remember back in my history when I had some serious anarthas, and I can remember back the devotees were revealing to me, but I wasn't humble enough to hear. Krishna had to smash me a little harder. But we should open our ears and hear. And it's the association of devotees.
Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati once said, "Flatterers are my enemies." So if somebody surrounds himself with yes men, as President Nixon did, and he was embarrassed publicly by being impeached, kicked out of his position, you can see that there's a danger there, just surrounding yourself with people that just pat you on the back and tell you how great you are. And I've seen over the years how some people, some even devotees, have become cartoons of themselves because they're being praised too much, and then they lose sight, they lose touch with the real situation.
Praise is so seductive. It's I can't think of anything more seductive than praise.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
Yeah. Sunil Prabhu. Hare Krishna.
Maharaj.
Hare Krishna, Guruji.
Maharaj, is it said that unless one develops a higher taste, one cannot give up the lower taste? So, Maharaj, if a devotee has not reached the pure stage, so is it normal for the devotee to engage in lower taste, like mundane gossip, sometimes on television, even though the devotee is subconsciously endeavoring in the path of pure devotional service, means consciously progressing, but because of the contamination of lower taste, he may subconsciously engage in lower taste. So is it normal, even though he's endeavoring on the path?
Well, in Bhagavad Gita, there's a beautiful verse you can study where Krishna says, Vishya vinavartante nirahasudehinam rasavarjam rasopyasya param dishvanavartate, that one may be restricted from the objects of our senses, though the taste still remains. But ceasing such engagement by experiencing a higher taste, one becomes fixed in consciousness. We have a higher taste. We definitely have something that is very, very, very sweet, which is much sweeter than sense gratification. But I think we all have to be honest and say that there is a lower side because we are not completely pure. At this stage, there is a lower side that is still attracted to sense gratification. And we must be very, very careful not to flirt with the objects of our senses. You know the verse that jayato vishyang pungsang sangasteju bhajayate, that when one meditates upon the objects of the senses, the first thing that happens, there's attachment. So it is normal that there will be attachment to lower things even while we have attachment to higher things, and gradually the shift will go that the lower becomes less tasteful and the higher becomes more tasteful. But it's a gradual process. So in the meantime, until we completely lose all taste, we find it disgusting. Just like King Kulasekar, who says that when I think of, you know, now that I've tasted the sweetness of the lotus feet of the Lord, now that I even think of sex, my lips curl in distaste and I spit. Well, probably most of us are not on that level yet. Attraction or taste may be there while we still have a higher taste. So we just have to be very, very careful that we are not, again, using the seduced, we're not seduced by those lower tastes. And by keeping association with devotees, that's really the safest position to be in. We're less likely to fall prey. And I think we all probably have, you know, occasional, you know, 10 steps forward and one step back. So many steps forward and one step back. I don't think any of us would say that our devotional progress has been, you know, a straight linear upward. You know, there's been a few little, you know, ups and downs, but much more ups and downs, and eventually we'll reach the point where there are no downs. So Prabhuji, just hang in there, and as that higher taste develops, that param drishva nivartante, by experiencing that higher taste, eventually you'll become completely fixed in consciousness.
Thank you, Maharaj. Very helpful. Maharaj, if a devotee develops, gets a lot of recognition and followers, and then that thought goes in the head that I false pride, if the thought keeps repeating, then how to overcome such weakness of the heart of getting recognition and followers?
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. So, Ramananda, how are you understanding that question?
Prabhuji? Just go ahead and repeat it. What basically you're saying is when that comes in your heart, how to overcome it.
Well, first, the first thing is to recognize it. The first thing is to recognize it. If we go back to what we just read, that King Bharat did not recognize that the weed of false ego was rearing its ugly head. This desire for pride, thinking that I'm the doer, that I'm the doer. Now, remember, he was alone. Now, I would bet that if there were, let's say, you know, others there with him at that time, they would have said, "Hey, you know, Prabhu, what are you doing? You know, too much attachment to this deer here." So it's the association again, the association of devotees and us all assisting one another on this devotional path and pointing out those weaknesses. Yeah, sometimes we cannot see things in ourselves, which, what do they say? Sometimes you can't see the forest through the trees. And that's why we need to have intimate relations with devotees. So many times we see devotees will cut themselves off from association and be kind of a loner. And almost always they're setting themselves up for the fall. We've got to have close relations with devotees, intimate relationships. Guyan akyati prichchiti. That would be my answer.
Still, when we see it, how do you deal with it? You can artificially try to deal with it, but what's the real method that gets it gone?
Well, let's again look at what did Raghunath Das say? He asked the question, how then can the pristine, pure love of Sri Krishna ever find a place in your heart? And then he was talking about this desire for adoration. He says, you will simply have to serve the unalloyed devotees of the Lord, who are his intimate associates and stalwart supporters. They alone can drive out this prostitute and enthrone pure love of Godhead within the heart. So we are associating right now with the entire disciplic chain by studying the Srimad Bhagavatam. As we come together every day, we are associating. Granted, I may be sitting here in Waimanalo, Madan Prabhu, you may be in Alachua, 5,000 miles away, but we are together. And no, all of us are together. And no doubt about it, Srila Prabhupada is present. And ultimately, Srila Vyasadeva, the ultimate speaker of the Bhagavad, the whole disciplic chain is here. We have that association. So we have to constantly, constantly take this association, and gradually that seed, that subtle, tenacious seed for adoration, distinction, pride, and honor, it will eventually die. All right, I got to go. So
One more question, looks like.
Okay.
Paco Luciano asking.
Okay. Ramon, we'll do one more. Dr. Luciano Prabhu, question?
Yeah, he wrote in the chat.
Okay, question, please. What the example given today, we can think that one should get evolved with, maybe involved with issues in the material world like saving a baby deer?
No, he said not get involved.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
With the example given today, should we think that one should not get involved with issues in the material world, such as saving a baby deer?
Well, okay, we got to take these on a case-by-case basis. Now, I mean, if I was at a river and I saw a deer that had somehow fallen in, I would probably just help him out, but I'm certainly not going to sacrifice my devotional practices to do such a thing, which is exactly what King Bharat did. He stopped worshiping the deity. He gave up his devotional practices altogether. I would do anything I could to save various animals. I'm certainly not going to give up chanting my rounds and missing Bhagavatam class, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
stupid.
I'm sorry?
Sorry.
We can't imitate King Bharat or Jada Bharat. You know, our situation is very different, and a case by case basis. If you're unsure, I mean, often I'm thinking, geez, am I doing the right thing in this situation or not? And often I'll call Ramananda Prabhu. Let me ask you, what are your thoughts on this? Or Madan Mohan or Vedagda Madhava. I mean, anyone among us. Often we can reach out and ask, you know, what are your thoughts on this? I'm a little unclear. Do you think I did the right thing or didn't do the right thing? Sometimes it's not always crystal clear, but don't take this out of context. If you see some animal or some person that's in some failing or situation of need, we have compassion. We'll try to help them, but we will not sacrifice our devotional life.
Could I add one more thing?
Okay.
At the end? Madan Mohan was saying what actually we should do when we see in ourselves this pride. And I think Raghunath Das Goswami mentions in Manashiksha that he says when we feel this anarthas that they are overcoming us, we have to call for help for devotees. And basically it's explains Sharanagati, surrender to Krishna, total surrender, because nice. We ourselves can't do anything. So
that's nice. Yeah, if we don't make one bit of advancement independent of our spiritual master and with the blessings of the Vaishnavas. Excellent point, Manaji. Thank you. That's a great answer to the question. Okay, so I guess we'll see everybody back here tomorrow. Hanuman Prasad Swami will be speaking, so thank you all very much, and always your Prabhupada.
Thank you, Prabhu. Great class. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.